From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made, well, we could have chosen many, but let's choose March 25th, 1994. The Washington Times newspaper ran an above-the-fold front-page story about its competitor, the Washington Post. The Times reported a story about Post reporter Michael Isikoff and his efforts to convince his editors to run a story he'd been working on, the story about a woman named Paula Jones alleging sexual harassment against President Bill Clinton. Now, internally, the reports say the Post had debated whether to run the story. Isikoff had apparently told the editors he had enough to go on. He didn't want to withhold information from readers. After a legendarily loud argument that we will find out if it was apocryphal with the deputy national editor Fred Barbash, Isikoff was suspended for 2 weeks, and now the Times wanted to know if the Post was protecting the president. Well, conservatives at the time praised Isikoff as a reporter with integrity who doggedly pursued a story. And through the Clinton White House years, maybe liberals were suspicious of Michael Isikoff, but how interesting that when George W. Bush was in the White House, it was conservatives claiming that Isikoff was unfair or ideological. That's what they used to say about all the toughest reporters, right? Glenn Simpson, investigative reporter for the Wall Street Journal, told the New York Times that Michael Isikoff, quote, will pull your fingernails out over coffee discussing lawn care. He is just a born interrogator. Today, Michael Isikoff is in Rochester. Speaking to the Monroe County Bar Association, that presentation that Mr. Isikoff's giving opened to the public at 4 p.m. today at the Plaza Hotel. But first, he's my guest for the hour. Michael Isikoff, welcome to Connections.
Good to be with you. And that quote kind of reminded me I probably should have been on with your previous guest who did the lawn mowing.
He's ruffled a few feathers there. You're no stranger to that.
Right.
Also in studio is Paul Nunes, not only a longtime friend of Michael Isikoff, but a longtime partner with Underberg and Kessler. And Paul, thank you for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me here, Evan.
I don't know if it's the proliferation of cable news, Michael, or the ostensible journalism of amateurs and many blog writers, but the public, when you see poll numbers, has a sort of a cynical view of modern journalism. Why do you think that is?
Well, because I think that look, the public is skeptical about a lot of institutions these days. I think the media is certainly among them, but you know, members of Congress, government, the legal profession, I think all get plenty of flack, and deservedly so. I mean, there have been some big mistakes that news organizations have made that get a lot of attention when that happens. But I think also the media landscape has changed so dramatically that and not in all ways that are positive. And I think that people watch the kind of nonstop yak fests on cable TV and the sort of ideological spinning that filters its way into those yak fests that they get turned off.
You just 2 months ago, you left NBC News
after
4 years as the national investigative correspondent. You said I read at least several comments where you said it was no longer working out. Can you tell us what was not working out?
Well, I think it was increasingly frustrating to try to get the kinds of stories that I do and went there to do on the air. I may have been a bit naive about what you can do on network TV, you know, for that, I'll take some blame going in. But look, network TV can have a very powerful impact at times. It can bring very dramatic images home to put them in millions of homes. But the ability to do sort of in-depth, aggressive investigative reporting is limited. I think that's part of a larger trend that is not always serving the American public.
Mike was talking about last night over a campfire about how there's real-time monitoring about how the audience is reacting to particular stories. And maybe
expand upon that. I mean, these shows, the news shows, are ratings-driven. And they pay a great deal of attention to the numbers and what moves the numbers, what moves the needle, and what doesn't. And if a story does not, it's a very tough sell. And certain kinds of stories weather stories, anything that's salacious or sex.
A disappeared plane.
A disappeared plane, even when there's no new information
boy, oh boy.
To say about the disappeared plane. Anything that moves the numbers will get on the air. Those that don't.
Michael Isikoff, our guest for the hour, and Paul Nunes, tell our audience again where he's going to be this afternoon, because they can't attend if they like.
Yes, they can. It's open to the public. Mike is going to be speaking for about an hour, hour and a half before the Litigation Council for the Monroe County Bar Association at the Plaza Hotel. It's an event open to the public. Happy that Mike has been invited and consented to come up to our fair city and they're going to get a taste of what his comments will be on your show today, Evan. So excited to have him at the Bar Association.
And after years at the Washington Post, of course, Newsweek, NBC News. What next, Michael?
Well, I am exploring a number of options at the moment and hope to have something to announce fairly shortly.
Before the end of this hour.
Unfortunately, it won't be before the end of the hour.
modern journalism has demands on a reporter that you didn't have when you broke in 70s, 80s, 90s.
Yeah.
You can't just work on a story and dive into the story for days or weeks or months and write it for print. Now you have to produce concomitant videos and blog posts and
right.
social media components as well. Does that get in the way of actual journalism?
It can. It can. I mean, look, you know, we're all in the jargon multi-platform actors now. You write, you blog, you do video. That's the trend that we're all going in. And that constant sort of demands of the web, what breaks through, some nugget that nobody else has, and you want to get that out there as quickly as possible. And sometimes the facts do suffer. Last year, I was covering for NBC the Boston bombing. And I remember vividly standing there in front of a camera for NBC, MSNBC. Right next to me, to the right, was CNN. And they were reporting that there had been an arrest in the Boston Marathon bombing at a time that there was not, in fact, one. And it was, you know, they got a pretty big black eye.
Were you hearing that at the time in real time?
Oh, yeah. I saw, you know, not only was I hearing it, I saw the buzz around the CNN folks as they were reporting this, and then the emails from my editors and in my ear, can you match this? Can you...
Because there's always that moment, especially the editors, the producers are panicked that someone else is beating them.
When you think you're getting beaten, and that's a sinking feeling we've all experienced many times, and you don't like it. But on the other hand, you got to be sure what you're doing is correct. And look, in an atmosphere like that, where so much is flying around and there's such a demand for any scrap of news, it's easy to see how somebody can make a big mistake and like that. But it's something we all have to guard against.
We're talking to Michael Isikoff, and I was careful not to just introduce him as the man who broke the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal, even though he is, because his career spans much more than that. In fact, we're going to talk about the various stories you've covered in your career. But I actually wanted to start with a more recent example. Here in Western New York, everyone seems to have Donald Trump fatigue. You know, he's going to buy the Buffalo Bills, he swears.
Deservedly so.
Exactly
right.
Believe it when you see it sort of a thing.
Yeah.
Earlier this year, Republicans were courting him to run for governor. Now, of course, he didn't want a primary, so he's not going to run for governor.
Yeah.
In 2011, he was making noise about a run for president. And at the time, a lot of people were, well, sort of annoyed that the media was even giving him the airspace. But you did something different. You actually dug into his business records, did some real investigative reporting, and then you somehow convinced him to sit down with you, and you confronted him with that. So what I want to do is I want to play a clip from NBC News, April 2011. This gives you a taste of Michael Isikoff sitting down with Donald Trump and the piece that aired on the Nightly News then.
Trump owns luxury properties all over the world and makes millions licensing consumer products. He's a brand name and a tough boss. Trump rules on his hit show, The Apprentice, now in its fifth season on NBC.
And Gary, you're fired.
But some critics say his own management should have gotten him fired. Trump hotels and casinos in Atlantic City filed for bankruptcy protection three times. They've since emerged from bankruptcy, his name still on them. Trump argues competition and rough market forces were responsible, and others were in control.
Wait a second, you were chairman of the board.
Excuse me?
You were chairman of the board.
I was chairman, but I didn't run the company. I had nothing to do with running the company. Management.
You were paid $2 million a year.
Excuse me, I didn't run the company. I'm just telling you.
So what were you paid $2 million a year for?
Excuse me. Because of my genius, okay?
Many of Trump's real estate projects are actually owned by others who license the right to use his name. Consider Trump Tower Tampa, a 52-story luxury condominium that Trump personally showed up to endorse in 2005.
I mean, I've had great luck in Florida, or whatever you want to call it. You could call it luck, you can call it talent.
The project looked spectacular, but never got off the ground, resulting in a tangled web of lawsuits, including one by more than 30 condo buyers.
Donald Trump left us high and dry.
All right, so there's a clip of Michael Isikoff's reporting on Donald Trump, one of the few reporters who actually did some real reporting. And so I have to ask you, why did Donald Trump agree to sit down with you?
You know,
that was a terrible idea.
It's a funny story because he was clearly torn and canceled that interview about an hour or so before it took place. But I went down there with the crew anyway. Because he had previously said he was going to do it. We just went in there. They had let the crew into the building, even though he was telling me he wasn't going to do it. And then he finally came out and sat down to do it. And then, you know, he later, I think, called me the worst reporter in America. So I think he regretted a sign that he was not happy about how that came out. But I think that, you know, for him, the conflict was he didn't really want to do the interview. He suspected it was going to be pretty aggressive and not altogether flattering. But on the other hand, the guy craves attention. He just craves publicity.
He can't help himself, can he?
He couldn't help himself. He couldn't help but sit down because I told him it was going to be on the nightly news that night. And so he just wanted to be on the news.
When you go through that process, and we're going to be talking about sources and the way journalism, some of the components actually come together with Michael Isikoff later this hour, but some sources or some interview subjects you will call and they will answer directly. Donald Trump probably never with that. I imagine you had to go through a phalanx of people just to get him to approve.
A few, although he did get on the phone. I mean, I think he was he did get on the phone with me. There were some pretty testy exchanges both before the interview took place. But like I said, I mean, for him, it was like, I mean, this is a guy who just can't stay out of the, you know, limelight. I mean, you know, look, the whole idea that he was running for president was pretty ridiculous. I mean, this is a guy who never actually has run for anything. And at the time, you remember, he was getting all this attention with this just complete nonsense about the Obama birth certificate and
which
giving
later
credence.
In that same story you covered as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, I mean, giving credence to this just, you know, this like wacky conspiracy theory that the president wasn't an American in some way. And I mean, you can legitimately say, should we have been giving him any kind of attention? And the kind of attention that we got. But on the other hand, he was getting attention. People were talking about him running for president. So it was at least worthwhile to point out some of the a fuller picture of his business record.
Exactly right. And that's why I wanted to bring this up, because so much of the airtime then in the ink was being devoted to Trump makes birther claim.
Yeah.
And then Obama denies. I mean, this just the silly false equivalence and all that stuff that sort of has kind of permeated the 24-hour news culture now, which I think is really...
That, I mean, look, that is a problem. Whenever you get into one of these sort of, you know, wacky conspiracy theories, there's the question of how seriously do you take it? And if you report on it, even to debunk it, are you fueling... You know, the quote controversy in some ways.
That effectively, well, I don't want to oversell that piece, but I thought his candidacy effectively started to end right around there.
Yeah, I mean, it did. Now remember, it was like a week or two later that Obama finally did release the birth certificate that showed, you know, in fact, it was real and the birther thing went away. I think it made Trump look pretty ridiculous. And, anyway.
Yeah, indeed. Well, and here's what I find equally compelling. You were working for NBC News.
Yes.
Which, of course, is the home of Trump's reality show,
yeah.
The Apprentice. And here
yeah.
you were essentially destroying the credibility of the man at the helm of that
yeah.
show.
Yeah.
And this wasn't a man who was saying, by the way, I'm good at cooking, and you said, no, he's actually not very good at cook. This was the very core of his being, that he was some genius in business. And did that provoke any issue within the network?
You know, I don't remember that as being a huge issue. We certainly had to deal with it. We covered it. He had a show on NBC Network, but as the entertainment division, not the news division. And in that case, at least, it didn't get in the way. And also, remember, I mean, going back to what we were talking about before, about ratings and the numbers and how slavishly they devote themselves to watching where the numbers are. He's good.
He's good for numbers.
He's good for numbers. He gets them, you know, he pumps them up. So they were happy to put him on.
We're talking to Michael Isikoff, longtime investigative journalist who is in Rochester today. His longtime friend Paul Nunes from Underberg & Kessler has helped arrange for a visit and is speaking this afternoon, 4 p.m. at the Plaza Hotel, which is still open to the public.
It's still open. Tickets available. Come on down.
And it's just a few hours away, but a perfect excuse to kind of get out and get a chance to talk to one of the really accomplished investigative reporters in this country. And I don't use that term lightly. A lot of people say investigative reporting, but I'm not sure a lot of people have the wherewithal to actually do it these days, Michael. That's another thing that I don't feel like editors and producers are willing to give time. The interesting thing about, I started with the Paula Jones thing, and you had this push and pull on whether mm-hmm. it gets published. Well, it feels like, especially on television, the second you've got something half done, a producer says, can't we just get that on the air? I mean, are you ready yeah. to turn it? Are you ready to turn it?
Right, sure. There's a big demand to be, as I said before, to be first with any kind of nugget, to get anything out there, and that does work, you know, against the kind of reporting that that I think is important, and I think, you know, serves the public a little better.
If you want to join the program or share your thoughts or questions with Michael Isikoff, you can call 263-WXXI, 263-9994 in Rochester, toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. The Fred Barbash story is legendary now. Is it true?
Well, it's true that there was a vigorous debate and confrontation about that particular story, and things got a little heated, and perhaps some expletives may have been used, but I don't think that's entirely unique in
you
newsrooms.
Wouldn't be the first report, no.
I don't. Yeah, I think more got made of it than probably needed to be. And look, at the end of the day, actually, the story did run. And you know, it's a tangled tale from there to Lewinsky, but it is, you know, it is part of the path that led to the president's later quite serious legal issues.
If you would have been told in 1992 that 24 years later it could be a Clinton-Bush presidential race again, would you have believed it?
No, and I'm, you know, it certainly looks like that is quite plausible at this point. But we are still, 2 years away. That's it's a long time in politics. I thought last night's interview, I didn't see the whole thing, but just the excerpts I did see were quite interesting. The Diane Sawyer interview with mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton, which Hillary Clinton said at one point when she was challenged about all the money both she and her husband have made since leaving office, quite substantial, said, well, you have to remember when we left office, we were broke.
Dead broke is the actual term.
Dead broke.
And that's going to hurt her.
And I think that's a reminder that she, when she gets her back up, she can say things that can come back to haunt her. And I suspect that one will. I mean, you know, people have already pointed out that this was during a time they were buying two huge houses, one in Chappaqua, one in Washington, D.C., both priced well over $1 million. She had just been elected to the U.S. Senate, so she had a pretty substantial income. The broke reference was to the fact that they had substantial legal bills. But if you know anything about how that operates and did operate in this case, the law firm Williams and Connolly was hardly pressing down the Clintons' neck to pay up at that point.
They were not functionally dead broke.
They were not broke in the sense that any average citizen would say they are broke.
Yeah. What's your relationship like with the Clintons these days?
Not much.
I imagine so.
We don't, you know, it's not. But look, I mean, I've at time to time, certainly during when she ran the last time, had occasion to report on the Clintons' finances and did reporting on it and dealt with her people who were, you know, not overly helpful, but, you know, did respond in some fashion. I think it's quite interesting that the kind of testiness between the Clinton camp and the news media, which goes right back to that era during the 90s when Bill Clinton was president, is still very much there. You still see that in the comments. You still see the fact that they push back very aggressively if there's any story that might be mildly construed as critical, and it suggests that to me that, you know, some of the defensiveness of the Clintons and Hillary Clinton that we saw back in the 90s that in many ways led to the problems they had are still there.
Are you concerned about dynastic politics?
You know, I think anybody looking at it, you know, we're a country of what, over 300 million people, and the fact that we're, you know, we might have a race between a Clinton and a Bush, you know, ought to raise some questions about, you know, shouldn't we perhaps have a more open process?
Okay. We're talking to Michael Isikoff, our guest for the hour, a longtime investigative reporter who soon enough will tell all of us, not this hour, but sometime soon, where his next move is. In April, he left NBC News after 4 years as the national investigative correspondent, and it was his work in the 1990s that broke the Clinton scandal wide open. But his work has carried through on national issues ever since, and I'm curious to know what you think about Glenn Greenwald, the reporter who broke the Edward Snowden story. You know, he said he thinks it's offensive that any other journalist would ask him if he deserves to be investigated or prosecuted. In particular, I'm thinking of him being upset with David Gregory on Meet the Press.
Right.
Is Greenwald producing great journalism, or is he too close to a source?
Well, the answer could be both. Look, I have a lot of thoughts on this issue, some of which I'll be talking about this afternoon. I think there's no question that the Snowden revelations are significant, have had real impact, meet my definition of important journalism in every respect, the proof is in the pudding. We've seen the president appoint a commission to review the surveillance policies of the country. We've seen a movement in Congress to change them legislatively. Already, the one program that got the most attention, which was the bulk collection of telephone data using a obscure provision of the Patriot Act, Section 215, to collect the records of phone calls that millions of us make, has effectively been ended by the president as a result of these revelations. So I think in that respect, it is important journalism and deserves to be applauded. I do think that there are still lingering and outstanding and in some ways growing questions about Snowden and his conduct and how he did it. What the legal consequences will and should be. And I think those deserve to be asked. And that doesn't for a moment discount the importance of what he has revealed. But if you just take Snowden's recent interview with Brian Williams, there are, you know, serious questions there. He claimed that he had first tried to blow the whistle internally. And took these issues to the general counsel's office of the NSA. And then the next day, the NSA released the email of what he had actually sent. And it was hardly any expression of concern. It was a very abstract legal question he was asking. And in fact, the last word from the NSA general counsel lawyer was, and if you want to discuss further, let me know. It was not, shut up, don't ask any more questions about this. Also, it's interesting the timing of that. That email exchange was April 5th. Well, if you read Greenwald's book closely, it's pretty clear Snowden had been planning to leak these documents for more than a year before that, and in fact had contacted Greenwald on December 1st of 2013. So the idea that, which is what Snowden claimed in that interview, that he had first tried to blow the whistle internally, just doesn't withstand scrutiny, which does raise questions about how much else Snowden has said that deserves to be examined more closely.
My issue with Glenn Greenwald is that anybody who criticizes him in any form becomes oh boy, he puts
look,
him in
you
the
asked
crosshairs.
About you asked about Greenwald, I gave you an answer about Snowden.
No, I didn't.
It's very clear that Snowden that Greenwald has been protective of his source, and you know, this is a trap that all of us who do investigative reporting have to be careful about. You can become too close to your sources, and what happens when the sources become part of the story? It was an issue I dealt with and wrote about quite extensively during my Clinton reporting, and wrote about it in the book I did Uncovering Clinton about Linda Tripp, and you know, who clearly who had been a source for me about the Lewinsky matter, but as I learned over time, you know, there were substantial issues about how she was doing what she did and what she had told me at what point in time.
Yeah, I think of sources, and I always remember sources are human beings. I mean, nobody fits snugly into one perfect category, but there are some motivated by money, some motivated by revenge, some motivated. I can think of a source in town who will call me when something is being underreported that he thinks the public good needs to hear about, and the only gain he gets is knowing that the public understands it better. And they're rare, but that those people do exist.
Those sorts of sources are very rare. There's always complicated motives.
Yeah.
There's always...
but as a reporter, you have to try to understand it as it's happening, don't
you? Yeah. You have to understand where the source is coming from. That doesn't mean that the source is not the most tainted sources can bring you the best information. And look, you know, we're talking about journalism here. How about the criminal justice system? How do federal prosecutors, state prosecutors convict anybody of importance? They get criminals who they can convict to spill the beans. And, you know, this is the standard drama in every trial. Somebody takes the stand and the defense lawyer points out, you've lied repeatedly over the years. You've committed all these crimes, right? You know, to impeach the source. But somehow our criminal justice system in some way or another, you know, still functions and people get convicted.
I always think of Jose Canseco. He's a weasel, but he was largely right.
Yeah. There's an example for you.
When you look back at your conversations with Linda Tripp and everything that led to that story breaking, was there a moment when you realized that obviously you'd reported on Paula Jones and other issues before? I mean, Bill Clinton was sort of well understood in terms of his personality, but was there a moment when you realized it was going to be what it became?
The moment that I got the tip that Ken Starr had launched an investigation and was doing a sting of Monica Lewinsky at the hotel in Northern Virginia. Because then I knew, regardless of – I'd been talking to Tripp for months before that, but regardless of what she was telling me and how much I could or could not prove, at that point there was a criminal investigation of the president, and that – one way or another, that was news. And in fact, I said at the time and wrote, you know, later, you know, this may be as much a Ken Starr story as it is a Bill Clinton story. And I think I was right. It was by launching that criminal investigation, you know, it provoked this enormous public controversy, and the country was very divided as to what took place.
Yeah. If you're waiting on the phone to speak to my guest this hour, Michael Isikoff, hang there. We're going to get you in just a second. One more question on the issue of sources. Throughout the past decade, you and other journalists have reported heavily on warrantless wiretapping long before Greenwald, Snowden, et cetera. You also reported on a story behind the story, so to speak. You wrote a Newsweek cover story on a man named Thomas Tam. And I've heard you say that the Tam story took about 18 months to work to work out. How careful did you have to be to produce that particular story, knowing you really had to nail it?
That was an amazing story, and you know, with all the attention that Snowden has gotten, it's worth remembering that the trail actually, the story actually, in some ways, begins with Thomas Tamm.
And I would have thought by now that would have had more attention, frankly.
I don't know if you saw the PBS documentary recently that traced the origins of this, and Thomas Tamm was a character
yes,
in that.
Indeed.
But Thomas Tamm was a lawyer for the Justice Department, came from a family of distinguished FBI officials. His uncle was a top aide to J. Edgar Hoover. His father was an FBI, a top FBI agent. His brother was a FBI agent. Anyway, he learned while working in the most sensitive national security unit of the Justice Department that the Bush administration had launched this warrantless wiretapping program that was bypassing the National Security Court, the FISA Court, Federal Intelligence Surveillance Court, and was very disturbed by this. Did raise it, internally. Did raise it with people within the Justice Department. Went to the Hill to raise it. Got nowhere with it. And then finally, called the New York Times and tipped them off to what was going on. He didn't know a lot. He didn't know a lot of details, but he knew that they were engaged in a surveillance program that was bypassing the federal court that was supposed to oversee such wiretaps. And this is what ultimately led to the New York Times breaking the story of 2005. In 2008, did a profile of Thomas Tamm because he had been under FBI investigation for leaking for more than 2 years. He had lost his job. He had had his house raided, his computer seized. He was in somewhat desperate straits. And I pointed out that this is a tale of what can often happen to whistleblowers. The New York Times reporters who broke the story, both, they won the Pulitzer Prize. They both wrote best-selling books. They did a great job. I don't want to take anything away from them at all. But it's worth remembering, while they reap the rewards of that of that journalism, one of the key sources who made it happen was suffering. And this is often the plight of people who do come forward and talk.
Worth looking up the story. You can find it still in the Newsweek archives, late 2008, on Thomas Tamm. Before there was Snowden, there was Tamm. And just a fascinating piece of work from Michael Isikoff, my guest for the hour, a longtime investigative reporter. And we're going to get to your questions next. He's here because Paul Nunes is also here from Underberg & Kessler. Paul, tell our audience where they can see Michael this afternoon.
Well, thanks, Evan. Mike is going to be at the Plaza Hotel as the guest speaker of the Litigation Council for the Monroe County Bar Association. And his comments will be as free-ranging as they are on your program today, touching, I think, primarily on the legal issues and the NSA issue. But
you don't have to be a lawyer to be there, Paul.
No, you do not.
You don't. That's...
We would welcome a few non-lawyers at these events.
I've seen your type. You need a few non-lawyers to break things up there.
Too many suits.
There you go. We're going to get to the phones next. Right now, shortest break in radio, then to the phones with Michael Isikoff and you on Connections on member-supported public radio. Wednesday on the next Connections, Education in Rochester. We attempt to follow the money. Who's pushing hard for the Common Core standards? Who has a stake in the outcome? Then in our second hour, we prepare for the start of the World Cup in Brazil. We'll have some fun with a short soccer preview, and we'll dive into Brazilian culture, politics, corruption, and more. That's Wednesday on Connections with Evan Dawson.
Have you been exploring Grandma's attic lately? Is that garage sale find worth its weight in gold? Join us for WXXI's second annual appraisal fair, Saturday, June 14th. Bring in your favorite treasure and have it appraised by one of our certified antique experts. For tickets and information, go public at WXXI.org/events or call 258-0200. Supported in part by ESL Federal Credit Union.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and glad to have Michael Isikoff and Paul Nunes with us in studio for the hour. Mike in Rochester, thanks for calling the program. Go ahead, Mike.
Oh, hi. You bring back fond memories. I could remember growing up 40 years ago, and I would pick up the newspaper and I would read a column by Drew Pearson and later Jack Anderson. In those days, we called them muckrakers. Is that a term that's appropriate nowadays? Because you're called like investigative reporters, and I just love that. You know, I love hearing that there are still investigative reporters, but I used to get the biggest charge out of reading those guys all the time. Do you have any comments about those early muckrakers?
Sure. Well, you know, unfortunately, that term has taken on a somewhat negative connotation.
Pejorative, yeah.
But it actually has a sort of rich history.
Yes.
Predates Drew Pearson and Jack Anderson. It goes back to the Progressive era. But, you know, they did some pretty amazing work, and Jack Anderson in particular.
Yes.
Back in the 70s, people forget, you know, he won the Pulitzer Prize. He was first on a lot of things about CIA abuses, about CIA efforts to assassinate Fidel Castro, you know, on and on. There's a great... there's a great book. Somebody did a great biography of him, which, and I will think of the name and author before this show ends.
Yes, I have a comment to make.
Since I turned back on my
opportunity,
iPhone.
It had to be 25 years ago, of meeting Jack Anderson. And actually, he gave a talk here in Rochester at a management club, even though I'm not a manager, but I got invited to it. And I got a chance to talk to him afterwards. And he passed along a comment that to me just seems to ring true to the day. And I asked him one time, he said the reason why he was successful, he says, one of the things that he never did and Drew Pearson never did is they never got in the inside crowd in Washington, D.C. They never went to the cocktail parties where you'd have maybe various politicians there with their wives and their children, et cetera, et cetera. And he says the reason why they did that is that they didn't want to be biased. In other words, he'd say, if I used to go to these into these kind of parties, then I might not want to write something negative about a politician because I met his lovely wife or I met his lovely children. So he says, we always tried to stay clear of the Washington crowd because and look upon as being an outsider because we didn't want to bias our reporting. Now,
I think that's a really good point, and I don't go to a lot of cocktail parties. I don't get invited to a lot of cocktail parties.
I was going to ask if you get invited.
So it's really
well,
not a tough
years, you
choice for me.
He's come all the way to Rochester for a cocktail party.
For a free meal. I mean, so, you know. You take what you can get.
But I think it's a fair question to ask, isn't it, Michael? I mean, to some degree, there is that pull of that's kind of the circuit, as they call it, and it's probably nicer for you to be outside that circuit.
Yeah. Look, and you know, you do get – it's easy to get sucked in. I mean, people like to be liked. People like to get invited places and all that. And so there is that. But there's unquestionably that tension. You know, every this is the first year in 17 years, I think, I didn't go to the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which is this huge bash where everybody in Washington goes, every reporter and hobnobs with all sorts of powerful sources and politicians. And, you know, it's gotten, you know, legitimate criticism over the years. How can you aggressively report on people when you're schmoozing with them? I actually had an interesting experience with the we talked about my Clinton reporting a little while ago. There was one year I got an award from the Correspondents Association for my reporting on that. And it's traditional that you go up and the president, you get the award and the president shakes your hand. And Clinton was still the president, and he actually chose to show up late for that event, so he didn't have to shake my hand.
Michael Isikoff, my guest, investigative reporter who perhaps the reason Bill Clinton didn't want to shake his hand is that it was Michael's work that broke the Lewinsky scandal in the 1990s, but his work has covered Abu Ghraib, detainees, all kinds of stories with drones, etc. We're going to talk in just a moment about some legal questions for reporters, but let's grab Bernard in Fairport. Thanks for calling, Bernard.
Hi, thank you. I have actually a follow-on to the previous call. If you were graduating from college, would you still want to be a reporter? And how would you define reporter? And I think your comments about NSA are very interesting because as a citizen who's not involved, at least anymore, with the NSA, it concerns me that that organization is going to have such an effect on the facts that unless you are a nasty, independent, unfriendly reporter, how are you going to get the information? And if you did get the information, how would you let us know? Would the news people allow you to talk? So it seems to me the whole job has changed, the environment has changed, and I'm very worried that we're losing something that's very, very important. And as a individual, I'd appreciate your comments on it. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Bernard.
Yeah. Well, in answer to your media question, I mean, I would still want to be a reporter because I can't imagine what else anybody would pay me to do. So I would still do it. But, yeah, look, I mean, you know, CBS 60 Minutes got inside the NSA last December and did a somewhat controversial piece.
I think quite controversial.
Yeah. John Miller, who was the CBS correspondent, got the interview with top NSA people, got CBS access to it, gave the NSA a chance to
gave them a softball.
Give its account of events. Now, John Miller, who's a fine reporter, but he also happened to have worked for not just the FBI, but also the DNI, Director of National Intelligence, which oversaw the NSA. And, you know, you can legitimately say, like, it's great that he got in there, but did he aggressively question them in the same way, say, Mike Wallace in the days of yesteryear would have in this grand 60 Minutes fashion? And I think that's always the tension. And I think that far too often you get the get, but then you don't probe as thoroughly and as aggressively as you should.
Miller's reporting definitely left a lot to be desired in my eyes.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not questioning his credentials as a reporter, but I was let down by that. You raised the question. What did you think about the report?
I would have liked to have seen more aggressive questioning.
Yeah,
but I have to tell you, I mean, not to, you know, speak out of school here. I'm not working at NBC anymore. I thought the same way about Brian Williams' interview with Snowden. There were a lot of follow-up questions that didn't get asked there. That
do you pull your hair out when you watch that going, just give me that seat? You know, is it hard for you to watch
this?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, you know, in your interview with Donald Trump, you asked him about his biggest mistakes, and he sort of infamously said he doesn't really think he's made any great mistakes or failures.
Yeah.
So in that spirit here, if Professor Isikoff was grading me here, we've had a nice conversation, but you have to at least let me ask you, what do you look back on with regret on any of the stories you've done?
Oh, on the stories I've done?
Yeah.
Oh, do you have another hour? I mean, we could speak endlessly. No, I mean, listen, there's no story that you do that you're ever completely satisfied with, because you always then think of the question you didn't ask or the point you didn't make, or that, or somebody raises another point that, God, I wish I had covered that. We all make mistakes. We make mistakes lots of times. None of us are perfect.
Is there one? The biggest one?
Is there a one in particular? Look, I
remember he's got a job interview that he's still working on.
I don't know. I don't know.
As his legal counsel,
my lawyer,
I may have
I'll get back to you on that.
Okay.
We'll submit that for the record. How about that?
Michael Isikoff, our guest for the hour here on Connections. And, so much of your reporting, you've covered drones. You've covered NSA.
Yeah.
And a lot of this, forget the fact of these subjects. You can go back to the very basics as a reporter, and the uneducated reporters, we've all met them, young people in newsrooms, et cetera. I was that way before. You will run into public officials who will tell you, I'm not going to give you this document. I don't care if you foil it. You're not going to get this. Or they're going to try to hold you out of a public space or hold a meeting in private, et cetera. Then you start reporting on actual, very complex legal matters, et cetera. And Paul Nunes is not all of our best friend here. So we don't always have someone we can call to instantly answer these questions. Are reporters today educated enough when it comes to legal matters?
Well, one of the amazing things, and this is something I will be talking about this afternoon, is the amazing creativity of lawyers to tell their clients, to come up with legal theories that allow them to tell their clients they can do what their clients want to do. And this was very much the case with the NSA surveillance. That data bulk collection was done through a rather creative interpretation of Section 215 of the Patriot Act, which the authors of the Patriot Act said they never imagined it could be used in a fashion, in the fashion that the NSA was. You mentioned drones. Last year, I got a hold of the Justice Department white paper on targeted killing of American citizens, the legal basis that the Obama administration was using to launch drone strikes against American citizens like Anwar al-Awlaki, who was in Yemen. And, you know, what is the legal battle? Anwar al-Awlaki hadn't been indicted. He hadn't been charged with any crime. Certainly hadn't been convicted. On what basis does the U.S. government decide that it can take somebody out?
There was a legal opinion, Michael, waterboarding being non-torture.
Right.
Legal opinion.
There are quite a few. But anyway, in the drone one, and this is an Obama administration document, they said imminent threat if the American citizen poses an imminent threat. And then
it's quite a broad definition.
Well, then you look into how they define imminent. And, you know, they explicitly say in this document, imminent doesn't mean we have intelligence of an active plot against the United States. Well, then what exactly does it mean? It means, well, you know, if we've had past information, past intelligence that suggests that they might be inclined to conduct terrorist acts against the United States, we can assume they are if they haven't renounced it. It was quite an elastic definition of imminence that had never been publicly discussed or certainly revealed to the American people. But it was a very graphic illustration of how lawyers can take the goal of what the government wants to do and come up with a legal justification to do it.
And yet some reporters would see that justification, that imminent threat, and sort of you report what you find and that's it. You have to know how to ask the right questions when you're sort of dealing with legalese. There's a book called The Most Beautiful Question in which the author argues that kids these days are not being trained very well to actually ask questions. Kids know that they can use a calculator or Google to get answers, but they're still not very good critical thinkers because they don't really know how to actually formulate the proper questions to get to the roots of answers. And he wants to see American education change that. Do you see reporters doing a decent job of that? And what would you tell a young reporter coming up now?
No, I mean, well, first of all, to be skeptical about everything, to question everything, to always look for the loophole, look for the weak link, because somewhere in something, whatever somebody in government or business is telling you, you know, they're gliding over something. They're trying to steer you away from something, and the point is to always sort of be on the lookout for what that is, what they're trying to steer you away from.
It's interesting to watch some of the coverage down in New Jersey, because if it's not going to be a sort of a dynastic politics election, a Clinton-Bush election, a lot of people had thought Chris Christie would be in that. And he may still. But I think there's still a lot of question about what will come out of what they call Bridgegate. And I was even surprised. I guess at this point, nothing will surprise you. You've sort of seen it all. Well, we think we've seen it all. I was surprised at how sloppy everything has been internally. And yet we still don't have any sort of a smoking gun that connects him and his own knowledge. What are the questions you still want answered going forward on that?
Well, look, I mean, I actually spent a lot of time in New Jersey reporting on this this year, and got quite close to that story. And it is true. No smoking gun has emerged that ties Christie to the decision to shut down those lanes on the George Washington Bridge. On the other hand, he had this big law firm, Gibson Dunn, which at taxpayer expense prepare this remarkable document that basically exonerated him and blamed it all on Bridget Kelly, the deputy chief of staff, and David Wildstein. The problem is we haven't heard their account. The key witnesses in this story have yet to be heard from. So I think it's premature to say that Christie is in the clear. And it's hard for me to see. And I totally agree. Had it not been for this, he would be among the most formidable, if not the most formidable, Republican candidate out there. And I think he would have been a very formidable candidate. But as long as these questions remain open, it's hard to see how he travels around the country, raises money, and mounts a credible campaign for president.
I thought the New York Times had a bit of a lapse when was it Wildstein who had said to the Times privately, "Hey, I've got evidence that Christie knew," and the Times is running stories that evidence that Christie knew, but all of a sudden no one could produce anything.
Right. Well, he wrote a letter his lawyer wrote a letter to the Port Authority that was very artfully worded to suggest that there was evidence that Wildstein was aware of, that Christie was aware of the decision to close the lanes, never actually said what that evidence was. Right. It's since been clear that, or been suggested that Wildstein had said something to Christie at the time they were taking place, but what he said and how he put it and what Christie heard and whether there are any witnesses, we still don't know. And until we hear Wildstein's account or we hear from the U.S. attorney, if we ever do, the book is not closed on this one.
Paul Nunes, tell our listeners one more time.
Come to Plaza Hotel, 4 o'clock, the litigation section of the Monroe County Bar Association. Michael will be speaking on NSA and assorted legal topics.
Paul Nunes from Underberg and Kessler, helping facilitate Michael Isikoff, longtime investigative journalist, who sounds to me like you've got plenty more work to do, even though we don't know where you're going next yet, Michael. Is that fair to say?
Yes, I've got plenty more work to do. And we'll be happy to come back.
Well,
how about that?
I hope you do come back here, even if you're not going to break news on this show. That's Michael Isikoff. Thanks to him, and thanks to all of our listeners. These 2 hours, I'm Evan Dawson. Thanks to Dave Campbell behind the glass. We'll see you on a Wednesday on member-supported public radio.